us. That's only if they find the names, I say. And that's why we have those plans for recontact if a year passes. I nod. Because if the replacement can't get the names, it's the only way they have of getting back in touch with you. I had no idea, he murmurs. He takes the flash drive from me gingerly, holds it between thumb and forefinger, studies it like it somehow holds all the answers. Then he looks up at me. I know we're thinking the same thing. If these are the names, Matt could stay out of jail. Yuri's dead. The blackmail's gone. The five names are gone. Whoever Moscow sends as Yuri's replacement won't be able to get his hands on the names. He'll have to wait for the sleepers to make contact, and if Matt doesn't, then he'll be free. Once and for all. It would be enough to keep us both safe, to keep anyone from finding out who he is and what I did. It would be a sweet victory if not for the cloud hanging over us. It doesn't matter in the least if Matt's safe or I'm safe. Someone's planning to hurt our son, our children, and I have no idea who. Then a thought hits me with such tremendous force, I'm breathless. But Luke might. The lobby's empty when I arrive, except for a lone security officer near the turnstiles, one who looks vaguely familiar. My footsteps echo in the cavernous space as I approach. I nod at her as I badge in, pass through the turnstiles. She nods back, expressionless, watching me. I walk through silent halls to the door of my vault, touch my badge to the reader, enter my PIN. There's a beep, then a click as the lock disengages. I push open the heavy door. It's dark inside and silent. I turn on the lights, flooding the space with harsh fluorescent lighting, and walk to my cubicle. I unlock my desk drawer and pull out the file, set it on the desk near the corkboard pinned with pictures of my family, drawings by the kids. It's thicker even than I remember, full of research into possible candidates for the ringleader, pictures of possible candidates. I sit down, pull the file in front of me, start sorting quickly, separating out the pictures and bio data from the other research, winnowing the pile by almost half. Luke might recognize someone. If we can identify him, we can protect the kids. It's no longer a nameless, faceless threat. It's a person, one we can go after and destroy. But the pile, it's still too big. How can I hide all this? My bag is too dangerous. All I need is for the security officer to stop me, rummage through it. I haven't come this far to get caught smuggling out classified material. My gaze drifts from the file to the picture of Yuri pinned to my cubicle wall, and my mind drifts too. The necklace, on his body, at all times, just like Dimitri the Dangle said. On his body. I stand, grab the pile of papers, head for the table in the back of the vault that houses the printers, the copier. There's a thick roll of tape there, a large envelope. I grab both. I slide the papers into the envelope, pull up my sweatshirt, stick it flat against the small of my back, start wrapping tape around myself. If anyone catches me like this, it's game over. All of this will be for nothing. But it's also the only way I can think of to try to figure out who the threat is. The Bureau would never show Luke a bunch of classified photos. So it's worth the risk, isn't it? Of course it is. And besides, they're not looking for people smuggling out paper. They're looking for electronic media. The odds of them finding this on me are slim, aren't they? I pull the sweatshirt back down. This might work. It actually might. I walk back to my desk to get my bag, sling it over my shoulder. I'm ready to leave when the drawings catch my eye. The one Luke made, me in the cape, an S on my chest. Slowly, I sink down in my chair and stare at it. Super Mommy, That's how Luke sees me, isn't it? For all my faults as a mother, he still sees me as a superhero. Someone who can solve any problem. Take care of him. I think about the man who visited him at school, who threatened him. How frightened must my little boy be? How much must he be craving a superhero right now, someone who can protect him, fight off the evil, fight the bad guys? I'm trying, buddy, I whisper. And then my gaze shifts to Ella's drawing, the one of our family. Six happy faces. That's the whole reason I'm in this mess, isn't it? Trying to keep those faces happy, all six of us. Is there still a way to have that? Gears are turning in my head, shifting, trying to sort through how this all might play out, how I can possibly keep my kids safe and keep my family together at the same time. And then I have an idea. I bend down to the drawers below my desk, the heavy metal ones bolted to the floor. I spin the dial first one way, then the other, find the numbers, unlock it, pull out a drawer, flip through the hanging files until I find the one I'm looking for. Inside, a report, red cover sheet, long classification string at the top, and another, farther back, just like it. I open them up, first one, then the other. I scan until I find what I'm looking for, a long string of numbers and letters, and then another. I copy them down on a post-it, fold it, and tuck it into my pocket. Then I head for the exit. It's the same security officer on the way out. She's at the desk near the turnstiles, a small television on in front of her, one of the 24-hour news channels. She looks up as I approach. Leaving already? Her face is serious. Yes, ma'am, I flash her a smile. I try to place her. I used to see her here in the mornings, I think. Just a quick visit in the middle of the night? I couldn't sleep. Some people turn on the television. My heart's pounding now. I know, nerdy analyst here. I raise my palms in mock surrender. She doesn't laugh, doesn't smile. I'm going to need to take a look in your bag. Of course. She walks over, and I'm sure she'll be able to hear my heart thumping, see my hands shaking. I fight to keep my face impassive and hold the bag out for her, open. She peers in, then sticks her hand in, moves a few things out of the way to get a better look. I catch sight of a pacifier, a baby food pouch. Then she pulls a wand from her belt, starts wanding my bag. You work nights now? I say, trying to pull her attention off the search onto me, trying to make myself appear less suspicious. She takes the wand off the bag, holds it near my head, runs it down the front of my body, close enough that it's touching me. I start to panic. That packet of papers against my back is thick. Too thick. The pay's better, she says. My oldest is off to college next year. She moves the wand to the other side, starts to run it up the back of my legs. I hold my breath, a shiver running through me, higher and higher, almost to my lower back now, almost to those papers. Just before it hits, I step away, turn to face her. Do you like it, working nights? I say with my best conversational look, one I hope looks natural because I'm absolutely terrified right now. I wait for her to tell me to turn back around, the wands still in her hand, but she hasn't made a move toward me. We do what we need to for our kids, right? She says, scowling. I hold my breath, hope she won't remember she didn't finish with me or won't care. Then she tucks the wand back in her belt, and the relief makes me dizzy. My body's gone weak, and the papers taped to my back seem suddenly so heavy. We certainly do. Then I take my bag and head for the exit, without looking back. Luke sits on the edge of his bed between Matt and me. We're closer than we need to be, almost like we're trying to give him strength, trying to let him know he's safe, that he's not alone. He's in his baseball pajamas, the ones that come up a little short at the ankles, another growth spurt. His hair is sticking up in the back the same way Matt's does when he wakes. He's still groggy with sleep, his eyes heavy. "I need you to look at some pictures," I say gently. He rubs one of his eyes, squints in the light, peers at me in confusion, like he's not entirely sure if he's awake or dreaming. I rub my hand in slow circles against his back. "I know this is strange, buddy, but I'm trying to figure out who talked to you at school so we can find him and make him stop." A shadow crosses his face, like he's realized that he's awake, that this is real, but it's the reality he wishes didn't exist. I wish it too. "Okay," he says. I pick up the papers from beside me and lay them in my lap. On top is a photograph, a headshot of a man with a serious expression. I watch Luke as he looks at it. I keep rubbing his back, wishing I didn't have to do this, make him sit here and relive the fear of being confronted by a stranger. He shakes his head, doesn't make a sound. I turn the page over, face down on the bed, and a new picture takes its place. A surge of guilt runs through me, showing him these faces that will probably haunt him the same way they haunt me. He looks at it quietly the same amount of time. I catch Matt's eye over the top of his head, see my guilt reflected on his face, the same question that's running through my mind. What have we done? Luke shakes his head again, and I go on to the next one. I watch him, the profile of his face. He looks so serious, so much older than his years, and I feel an overwhelming sense of sadness. I flip through page after page. He looks at each one carefully, methodically, for the same amount of time before he shakes his head. Soon we've fallen into a rhythm. 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, shake head, flip the page. We're nearing the end of the pile now, and desperation is starting to take hold. What do I do next if this doesn't work? How am I going to find the man who's threatening him? 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, shake head, flip the page. 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. Nothing. No shake of the head. I go still. Luke is staring hard at the picture. I'm afraid to even breathe. "This is him," he says, so quietly I almost can't hear him. Then he looks up at me, those wide eyes like saucers. "This is the man." "Are you sure?" I say, even though I know he is. I can see the confidence, the determination on his face, the fear. "I'm sure." Chapter 24. I stand in the kitchen, my back against the counter, mug of steaming coffee in one hand, the picture in the other. Anatoly Vashenko. I stare at him, the long face, the receding hairline. I'm looking at the face of the ringleader, the man who's a threat to Luke, to all of my kids. I turn the picture over, look again at the text on the other side, the biodata, everything I was able to dig up on Vashenko that we could use to track him down. It's short, one of the shortest in the pile, barely any text at all. My eyes focus on one line in particular. Travel to U.S. None known. None known. I blink at the words, willing them to change. But they don't, of course. They stare back at me, taunting. Obviously, he's traveled to the U.S. He's here right now. And if we don't have a record of him being here, he's using an assumed identity. Which means we have no way to track him down. Luke's asleep and all is silent, except for the occasional clack of typing from the family room. Matt on the laptop, working on decryption. Typing. Then a long pause. More typing. More silence. I take a sip of coffee, taste the bitterness on my tongue. I feel like I'm deflating inside. I found the ringleader. I actually did it. And what does it matter? I don't have enough to track him down to do anything about it, certainly not in time. Luke dies tomorrow. I can't get those words out of my head. He's out there, menacing Luke, and I'm powerless to stop it. Powerless to stop it on my own. The thought's in my head, clawing its way to the front. I'm trying to push it back, push it away, keep it from fully forming, but I can't. It's the only way. I leave the picture on the counter and walk into the family room, mug between both hands, trying to warm them. Matt's on the couch, leaning forward, his laptop open on the coffee table in front of him. A flash drive's attached, a little orange light lit. He glances up as I enter, his face tight, tense. I sit down beside him, look at the screen. The jumble of text, indecipherable to me. The characters he's typing, a string of them. "Any luck?" I say. He sighs, shakes his head. "My encryption code's not enough. It's multi-layer, pretty complex stuff." "Do you think you can crack it?" He looks at the screen, then back at me, regret and frustration all over his face. "I don't think so." I nod. The fact doesn't surprise me, not in the least. They're good, the Russians. They've designed this so no one can break in, not without the other decryption codes. "What do we do now?" he asks. I search his face. I need to see exactly how he's going to react to all of this. Because I think I trust him. I think there's an explanation for everything. But I need to be sure. We go to the authorities. His eyes widen, just the smallest bit. I can read surprise, but little else. "What?" "It's the only way to keep Luke safe." "But we know who it is. And that's all we know. We have absolutely nothing that can help us find him. Nothing. But the authorities, they would." His eyes haven't left mine. I see hopelessness, desperation. "There's gotta be some other way." I shake my head. "We have a name, a Russian name. Nothing on his alias, his location. Maybe if we had more time..." I watch him process the information the way I've been forced to. It's the only way. We can't track him down on our own, not in time. "Luke dies tomorrow," I say quietly. "What if he comes for Luke and we can't stop it?" The crease in his forehead deepens. He's still thinking. I can see it. "You're right," he says. "We need the help." I wait for it, the next question, the one I know is coming, because this is when it'll really matter, his reaction. I need to see how he'll react when I say it. "So what do we tell them?" he finally asks. And I hear the unspoken part of the question, the one I've been running through my mind as well. How do we get their help without implicating ourselves? I look up, meet his eyes, memorize the expression, wait to see how it'll change. "The truth." "What?" He stares at me in utter confusion. I watch him closely. "We tell them everything." There's a flash of something in his eyes, disbelief, I think. "We'll go to jail, Viv. Both of us." I can feel emotion welling up in my chest, an intense pressure. Being in jail would mean life as I know it is over. I wouldn't be there for the kids. I'd miss their childhoods, their lives. They'd hate me for leaving them, for turning them into a media spectacle. He blinks at me, and the incredulity morphs into frustration. "You're just giving up? Now, when we're so close?" "I'm not giving up. I'm not. That much I know for sure. I'm just finally standing up, doing what's right, what I should have done a long time ago. After all of this was for the kids, I interrupt. And this is still for the kids. There has got to be another way, some story. I shake my head. I need to stay firm here. Because he's right, there probably is another way, another lie we could tell. I could sit down with Omar, spin a tale that he might buy, that might be enough to keep us out of jail, to keep Luke and the other kids safe. I don't want any more stories. I don't want something that's going to bury us deeper, spiral us further down in deceit. I don't want to spend the rest of my life looking over my shoulder, waiting for the other shoe to drop, terrified I've made the wrong decision, that my children are still in danger. I want them in witness protection. I want them safe. And I don't want to take any chances. They won't understand how much danger the kids are in, how much of a threat Fashenko is, or even why he's threatening the kids, unless we come clean, I say. We need them protected. This is what's best for them. Both their parents in prison, that's what's best? A cloud of doubt is forming over me because honestly, I don't know. But in my gut, I feel like this is right. It's the way to keep them safe. And besides, how can I be the mother I need to be if I let the rest of my life be a lie? How can I teach the kids right from wrong? All the times I've chastised them for fibbing, all the times I've told them to do what's right, they're all running through my mind like a movie reel. And Peter's words, I trust you'll make the right decision, whatever that is. Maybe it is, I say. I'm still holding on to a fragment of hope that it won't happen, both of us in jail, but I can't tell him that, not yet. And I know, deep down, that we probably will end up behind bars. But maybe what's best for them isn't us all being together after all. Maybe it's making absolutely sure they're safe, that we're teaching them to do what's right, even if it's difficult. Maybe someday they'll look at everything I've done, everything Matt's done, and they'll understand. But if we keep going like this, keep living this lie another 10, 20 years, or until whenever the authorities finally catch up with us, then what? How will we be able to look them in the eye again? I pull my phone out, lay it carefully down on the ottoman in front of us. I see Matt look at it. I take a deep breath. I trust you. I hope you can see that now. But you can still leave. I won't call until you're on a plane out of here. He looks at the phone a moment longer, then his gaze shifts to me. Never, he whispers. I'd never leave you. He reaches for my hand. I feel his fingers encircle mine, warm and so familiar. If you think this is what we need to do, then we'll do it. This is Matt, my husband, the man I know, the man I love. I was wrong to ever doubt him, so very, very wrong. I let go of his hand, reach into my pocket, pull out the little square of paper, unfold it, lay it down on the ottoman, the two long strings of characters visible to us both. There's one more thing I want you to do. Dawn is breaking when Omar arrives at our house, alone, just as I asked. I greet him at the door and usher him inside. He enters warily, one cautious step forward, then another, his eyes looking around the room, taking everything in. He doesn't say a word. I close the door behind him, and then we stand awkwardly in the hall. I feel a flash of regret for calling him here, an urge to back out. There's still some time to get out of this. Then I lift my chin. It's the right thing to do. It's the only way to keep my kids safe. Let's go sit down, I say, nodding in the direction of the kitchen. When Omar doesn't move, I start leading the way. I hear his footsteps behind me. Matt's already sitting at the kitchen table. Omar sees him and stops, eyes him, then gives him a nod. Still doesn't say a word. I scoot Chase's high chair out of the way and drag Luke's chair to the end of the table, gesture for Omar to sit. He hesitates and then does so, lowering himself into the chair. I sit in my usual spot across from Matt. I glance up at him and suddenly I'm at the table weeks ago, the day I learned the news that would change my life. All of our lives. There's a folder in front of me at the table, the paper I need nestled securely inside. I see Omar's eyes land on it, then travel up to my face. "What's going on, Vivian?" he says. My voice, my body, everything suddenly feels paralyzed. Is this really what's best for the kids? "Vivian?" he says again, confused. "It is. It'll protect the kids. I can't do it on my own. I can't keep them safe." I slide the folder over to Omar, my hand trembling. He puts a hand on it, his eyes on me, quizzical. He hesitates, then opens it gingerly. I see the headshot, the one Luke identified. "Anatoly Vashenko," I say quietly. "Yuri's handler, the ringleader." He's staring at the picture. He finally looks up at me, his face like a question mark. "He needs to be arrested immediately, and I need protection for all my kids until it happens." His eyes shift from me to Matt and back to me again. He still hasn't said a word. "He threatened Luke," I say, my voice cracking. "He's a threat to my kids." He exhales softly, his eyes locked on me. He gives his head a shake. "What the hell's going on, Vivian?" "I need to get this out, all of it." He'll have a necklace, a pendant, a cross, I think. There should be a flash drive embedded inside. It'll have the names of his 5 handlers. Omar blinks. He looks stunned. "Matt can walk you through the decryption process," I add softly. "His code, ours from Moscow, the one from Dmitri the Dangle." I glance at Matt, who nods grimly. Once I gave him the other decryption keys, it hadn't taken long for him to get into the folder, to find the 5 pictures. The same 5 I saw that day at work, a lifetime ago. But with text, this time. Addresses, occupations, and access. Instructions for signaling meetings. I actually didn't expect to see the same faces, the other 4. Once I realized the pictures were planted, I felt sure the others were fake. But maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. Maybe it was proof of their arrogance, their confidence that they knew exactly how everything would play out. "The handlers all have them, too, with the names of their 5 agents," I say. I set down Yuri's necklace, the heavy gold cross, the flash drives tucked back inside, the screws tightened. "The 5th name's in here." Omar's eyes widen ever so slightly, his jaws gone slack, his mouth open in an unconscious O. I've stunned him. He shifts his gaze to Matt, and Matt nods. "Viv didn't know," he says. His voice breaks. And my heart breaks to hear it. "I kept it from her." Omar turns back to me. I feel like I owe him some sort of explanation, but I don't know what to say. "They get you where you're most vulnerable," I finally settle on. "With us, it was our family." His eyes are disbelieving. "He would have come in from the cold," I say softly. "Years ago." Omar looks away. Something changes in his face. "Exactly the kind of person I thought we might find." He hasn't made a move for Yuri's necklace. I place my index finger on the pendant, slide it closer to him. What's going to happen next? That flicker of hope is still there, but it's so faint, so very faint. In any case, it was the right thing to do. It's the way to keep the kids from harm. More likely, he's going to call for backup, place us under arrest. My parents should be back soon, but now I wish I'd insisted they stay the night. And the kids, The poor kids. What if we're gone by the time they wake up? He's still staring at the necklace. There's a strange feeling creeping over me. That glimmer of hope intensifying. Maybe this'll work. Maybe it'll be enough. Finally, he places his own index finger on the necklace, but instead of pulling it toward himself, he pushes it back to me. "You'll be needing witness protection then," he says. A tingling sensation runs through my body like electricity. Did this actually succeed? I look down at the necklace back in front of me now. He doesn't want it. He's not going to take it to see the fifth name. Matt's name. I'm trying to wrap my mind around the words, trying to understand if this is really happening. I look at Matt and see his confusion. We didn't talk about this. It seemed so unlikely. And if there really was a chance of it working, I didn't want to jinx it. "Witness protection?" I say, because I don't know what else to say. It takes Omar a minute to respond. "You just gave me enough information to disrupt the entire cell. Certainly the Russians wouldn't take kindly to that. And if they're already threatening Luke..." I look down at the flash drive. I shouldn't get my hopes up, not yet. Maybe he didn't understand that Matt's the fifth sleeper, that I knew about it, that we both belong in jail. "I've done some things wrong. I'll tell you everything." "Everything we've been investigating," Omar says, holding up a hand as if to stop me. "Everything we attributed to a mole or to a Russian agent with access to CIC, Peter confessed to." He drops his hand, looks from me to Matt, then back again. "I'm confident that the fifth sleeper hasn't done a thing to harm national security."
Oh my God. This is really happening. Omar's going to let us go. It's what I hoped. It's what I thought might possibly keep us out of jail, keep our family together, give them enough information for freedom. It only works, though, if he can keep the kids safe.
"The kids will be protected.
That's the only thing we care about."
"I know."
I'm quiet for a moment, still trying to process everything. "How will it work?" I finally ask.
"I'm going to walk myself right into the director's office with information that'll disrupt the entire cell. He'll give me what I want.
But
I'll say Matt admitted to being a sleeper, that he gave me the ringleader's name, gave me his encryption code, let me know about the necklaces, and that in exchange, we're going to protect him and his family."
"But what if someone finds out?"
"We'll keep it in compartmented channels, highest classification."
"Can you..."
I begin, and again he cuts me off. "It's Russia. Everything's compartmented."
I hear the words I myself have spoken so many times, the ones I know are true, the ones that mean maybe, just maybe, this could work.
"Will the director agree?" I ask, my voice almost a whisper.
"Even if Omar wants to do this for us, there's no guarantee he can, right?" He nods. "I know how the Bureau works. I'm confident."
Hope is radiating through me. Hope that maybe we'll be safe and together after all.
I look at Matt and see the same emotions mirrored on his face.
"What now?"
I finally ask. Omar smiles at me. "Pack your bags."
1 year later. Chapter 25. I sit in the sand on the little crescent beach and watch the kids. Chase is running along the edge of the surf, sturdy little toddler legs churning across hard-packed sand, a seagull skipping along in front of him. Caleb stands behind him, blonde curls glistening in the sun, watching, squealing in delight as the gull takes to the sky. Ella's farther up the beach, packing sand into bright, turret-shaped buckets, concentration on her face, an elaborate sandcastle in front of her. And out in the ocean is Luke, belly down on a boogie board, waiting for the next wave. Water glistens off his back, and the legs that seem to lengthen by the day tan from the sun and the hours spent out here in the surf. A warm breeze blows by, swaying the fronds of the palms that dot our little beach. I close my eyes and just listen for a moment. The soft crash of waves, the rustle of the palms, the sounds of my kids content and happy. The most beautiful, mesmerizing symphony that could possibly exist. Matt comes up behind me and sits down in the sand next to me, close, his leg touching mine. I look at them, our two legs, both tanner than they've ever been, almost brown against the fine white sand. He smiles at me and I at him, and then I turn back to watch the kids, content to sit in companionable silence. Luke catches a big wave, rides it in, all the way onto the sand. Caleb takes a tottering step, then another, then sinks down to the sand and scoops up a large shell, examines it. 24 hours after we sat at our kitchen table with Omar, we were on a private plane heading for the South Pacific. At first, when Omar said to pack our bags, the thought was terrifying. Packing up our lives into suitcases, knowing that anything we left behind we might never see again. And so I focused on the things most important to me. The things that were irreplaceable. Photos, baby books, that kind of thing. As it turns out, that's all I really needed. All the other stuff in our house, the closets full of clothes and shoes, the electronics, the furniture. Well, I still don't miss it. We started over here. Simply. Bought the essentials. We have one another and our memories, and that's all we really need. My parents came with us. Omar offered it up as an option, and I went to them with it, even though I didn't think they'd do it. Didn't think they'd want to be ripped away from all they knew. But once they heard they wouldn't be able to communicate with us for a year, maybe more, there was no hesitation. Of course we'll come. My mom said, "You're our child. You're everything to us." And that was it. Decision made. One that I understood completely. And things between Matt and me are solid again. "I forgive you," he said the first night in the new house as we lay in an unfamiliar bed. If he could forgive me for doubting him, for making him feel like he had to kill to earn my trust. Surely I could leave the past in the past. I curled up into his arms, the place I knew I belonged. "I forgive you, too." I hear a helicopter in the distance, the faint whir of the propellers. I watch as it comes into view, growing more distinct as it approaches, louder, the gentle whir becoming a rhythmic thump, thump, thump. The kids have all stopped what they're doing to watch. It passes right over us, so loud that Ella and Luke cover their ears. Chase and Caleb just stare in wonderment. Helicopters aren't something we see here. They settled us on a remote part of the island, two houses set on bluffs overlooking the ocean, bookending a little crescent stretch of beach below. I never knew how Omar managed to do it, the houses, the living expenses, all of it. He told me not to worry, that after all we'd done for our country, we deserved it. And I didn't press it. It was the first time in as long as I could remember that I didn't have to worry about money. I look up at my parents' house now and see my mom step outside. She slides the glass door closed behind her and starts walking down to the beach, the breeze billowing her long skirt around her legs. I turn around and see the helicopter hovering above the bluffs behind us, coming down slowly, perpendicular to the ground, for a landing. Matt and I exchange a look. Wordlessly, we both stand, brush the sand off. We wait for my mom to reach us. "Go ahead," she says. "I'll keep an eye on the kids."
The sound from the propellers quiets as we trudge up the hill to our house, over white sand dunes that slide away with each step until we reach the wooden stairs, dusted with more sand. We walk up until we reach the top, the patchy grass that passes as a lawn, the square, two-story house with the sharply slanted roof, terraces all around. I see Omar approaching the house from the direction of the helicopter, wearing khaki cargo pants, a flowered Hawaiian shirt. He breaks into a smile when he sees us. We reach the front of the house at the same time. I embrace him, hugging hard, and Matt shakes his hand. There's something oddly thrilling about seeing him here. He's the first person from back home we've seen in a year. He warned us, told us we'd be on our own for a year, possibly longer, but still we were unprepared for the strange sensation of being completely cut off from everything, the people we knew, the routines, even things like email and social media. He'd given us a cell phone, but with strict instructions to power it on and use it only in case of emergency. Short of that, we were just to wait for him to make contact. And now, here he is, a year to the day later. "Come on in," I say to him, opening the front door and leading the way. The house is airy and full of light, all white and blues, and it feels more like home than our home ever did. Seashells adorn the place, ones we've gathered from walks on our beach, and photographs. So many photographs, black and white shots of the kids, of the palm trees, of anything that catches my eye. It's nice to have time for hobbies again. Most of all, though, it's nice to have time for my kids. I lead him into the family room and sit down on the couch, a well-worn blue sectional, the one we all crowd onto for movies and game nights. He sits on the opposite side. Matt comes in a moment later, a pitcher of lemonade and two glasses in his hands, and sets them on the coffee table. He gives me a smile. "I'll give you two some privacy," he says. I don't stop him, and neither does Omar. When he's out of the room and we hear a door close upstairs, Omar leans forward.
"So how's life here?"
"Wonderful," I say, and I mean it wholeheartedly. I'm happier than I've ever been. I don't feel trapped anymore, stuck in a life that's just happening to me. I feel in control of my life, and my conscience is at peace. I'm going to finally have the life I want. I pick up the pitcher and pour lemonade into each glass, ice cubes clinking against the sides.
"School? I know you were worried about that."
I hand him a glass. "We've been homeschooling. It's not a long-term solution, but it's been working. The kids are actually learning a ton."
"And Caleb?"
"Doing so well. Walking, even saying a few words. And he's healthy. You were right. The cardiologist on the mainland is fantastic."
"I'm glad. You have no idea how often I think of you guys. How much I've wanted to check in."
"Me too," I say. "There's so much I want to know." I pause. "How have you been?"
"Great, actually."
He takes a sip from his glass.
"I'm the new deputy director, you know."
He's trying and failing to contain a grin. "That's amazing!" The grin breaks free. "And you deserve it, totally."
"Well, this case did a lot for me, not gonna lie."
I wait for him to say more, but he's quiet, the smile slipping away. My mind drifts to Peter, and I wonder if his has too. "Finally," I speak. "Can you tell me anything about the cell?" It's a question that's been at the forefront of my mind for a year now. I'm desperate to hear what he has to say.
He nods. "You were right about Vashenko. He was the ringleader. We tracked him down pretty quickly. Found the flash drive embedded in the pendant, just like you said, and decrypted it with the keys you gave us."
I clasp my hands tightly in my lap and wait for him to go on.
"From there, we arrested the other four handlers. 3 days later, we had a major operation, arrested all 24 members of the cell."
"We heard about it," I say.
It was a major news story, even here, although everything I read about the operation said 25 operatives. Alexander Linkov was identified as one of those arrested, though details about him were scarce, and the only photograph released was pixelated enough to be indistinct. Luckily, I don't think anyone would have recognized him as my husband. What's going to happen to them all? He shrugs. Jail, prisoner swap, who knows? He eyes me for a moment. I'm sure you read that most of them are claiming they were framed, that they're actually political dissidents, enemies of the state, that kind of thing. I nod and smile. At least they're consistent, I guess. He grins, then turns serious again. The Bureau finally approved the come-in-from-the-cold op. We got 2 recruits that way so far. We're working on using them to disrupt another cell. And we're using your algorithm to try to find other handlers. There's a huge amount of resources devoted to it, FBI and CIA. I'm quiet for a moment, letting everything sink in. They disrupted an entire cell, and they're making progress on finding others. I shake my head in wonderment, and then I ask the other question that's on my mind, the one that's more pressing, that frightens me far more. And Matt? Do they suspect him? He shakes his head. No indication the Russians know he's still out there, or that he had any involvement. My eyes flutter closed. A weight lifts itself off my shoulders, freeing me. It's what I'd hoped. The news stories seemed to credit the disruption to Peter, described as a longtime CIA analyst preyed on because of his wife's illness, then blackmailed. And to a Bureau agent identified simply as O. And as for you, he goes on, you're listed as taking a temporary leave of absence. It's pretty well known in CIC and the Bureau that it has something to do with this case, and there's a rumor going around that the Russians blackmailed you and you resisted. But no one at the working level knows the details. Who knows the truth? Me. The directors of the FBI and CIA. That's it. I can feel my tension draining away. This conversation couldn't be going any better if I'd written it myself. But at the same time, what does that mean for us here? I feel a surge of sadness, like everything around me is tenuous, might be pulled away in a heartbeat. I'm almost afraid to ask the next question. So, what now? Well, from everything we've seen, it's safe to return. We can get you back into your house, your job. My mind drifts, even though I don't want it to. The kids at daycare all day. Seeing them just for brief snippets in the morning and again at night, if I'm lucky. I try to push away the thought. We'll iron out all the details in the coming weeks. We'll get Matt some new documents, birth certificate, passport, etc. Something that'll hold up to any scrutiny. He pauses, looks at me expectantly. So I offer him a weak smile. We'll make the transition back as smooth as possible, Vivian. Nothing to worry about. And we'll do some amazing work together, you and I. More disruptions. He trails off, looks at me with a strange expression on his face. That's what you want, right? I don't answer immediately. It's odd. Being in this moment because for the first time, it's actually my choice. I'm not trapped in a job that I'm no longer sure I want. No one's manipulating me, pressuring me to do anything. I can do whatever I want. I can choose. Vivian, he presses. Are you going back? I blink at him. And then I answer.
Matt and I had celebrated our 10-year anniversary at the beach just as we'd hoped. We sat in the sand on the Crescent Beach and watched the kids play, toasted with plastic cups of cheap sparkling wine as the sun slipped closer to the horizon, bathing our world in reds and pinks. "We're here after all," he said. "Together. All of us." I listened to the crash of the waves, the squeals and giggles of the kids, and I remembered the last time we'd talked about it, the plans for our anniversary, a trip to an exotic beach. It was the morning I found Matt's picture, just before everything fell apart. I was transported back to my cubicle, the high gray walls, the ever-present feeling of floundering, of failing, of being torn between two things that were so important to me, each of which demanded more time than I could give. My throat tightened just thinking about it. I dug my toes deeper into the sand and looked at the horizon, the sun sinking ever lower. And I said the only thing that was on my mind in that moment. "I don't want to go back to the job." It was out of the blue, really, because we hadn't talked about work, not since we'd left the States. I mean, if it's even an option. It felt good, saying what I wanted, making a choice, being in control. "Okay," Matt said. "Just that. Okay. I want to sell the house," I said, pushing further. "Okay." I turned to face him. "Really? I know you love the house." He laughed, shook his head. "I don't love the house. I hated it in the beginning. Hated that I talked you into it just so you'd be trapped in your job." The words felt like a blow, one I should have seen coming. I curled my toes deeper in the sand and looked back at the ocean. "I love the memories we've made there," he added. "But the house itself? Nah." I tried to process the thought, the realization once again, that so much of what I believed to be true wasn't really true. "I love you, Viv, and I want you to be happy, really, truly happy, like you were when we first met." "I'm happy," I said, but the words rang false. Was I? Being with the kids, with Matt, I was happy. But there was so much about my life that didn't make me happy. "Not the way you deserve to be," he said softly. "I haven't been the husband I want to be." I should have said something, should have argued, but I didn't. The words didn't come. I think maybe I wanted to see what he was going to say. "When you went back to work after Luke was born, that day you came home and said you couldn't do it, couldn't leave him. There was nothing I wanted more than to say don't, to say we'd sell the house, I'd get a second job, whatever. It killed me to tell you to hang in there, to stick it out. I knew how unhappy it made you, I knew. And it killed me." I felt tears spring to my eyes, thinking back to that day, one of my lowest. I watched the kids through the blur, a game of tag, Luke sprinting so fast, Ella keeping up, Chase toddling behind, trying so hard, and Caleb, sweet Caleb, standing, taking a few hesitant steps, laughing. "There are so many times I've let you down. When I convinced you to work Russia, when we found out it was twins. I was so focused on keeping our family together, so afraid they'd order me to leave. I put that above being there for you. And I'm sorry for that, from the bottom of my heart." I watched the sun slip below the horizon, the ball of fire disappearing. The brilliant reds and oranges had given way to deep pinks and blues, streaks in the sky. "I haven't liked the person that I've been, but I want to rebuild. I want to start over, to be the husband I know I can be, the one you deserve." The kids were still running in the sand, oblivious to the sunset, to our conversation, to the choices we needed to make. Their shrieks trailed over, mixed with the sound of the waves.
"What do you want, Viv?" Matt asked.
I looked over at him, his features muted now in the dusk. "A fresh start?" He nodded, waited for me to go on. "I want time with the kids."
"I want you to have that. We'll make it work."
"And I don't want any more lies."
He shook his head. "Neither do I."
I ran a finger through the sand, drew a wavy line. "Is there anything else I should know? Anything you're still hiding?"
He shook his head again, more adamantly this time. "Everything's on the table. You know it all."
We were quiet for a few moments. Then he opened his mouth to say something, closed it again. I could feel his hesitation. "What is it?"
"It's just..."
"What?"
"Well, the job. You've worked so hard to get where you are, and you're doing such important work." He gave his head a quick shake. "Now is not the time to talk about it. I just want you to make the right choice. The one that'll make you happy."
Then he shifted so that he was facing me. He took my hands, stood, pulled me up to my feet with him. His words were echoing in my head, the ambivalence I'd felt for all those years creeping back into my conscience. Then he pulled me close, gently, his hands on my waist. And I realized he was right about one thing, at least. This wasn't the time to talk about it. I'd have a year to think. I wrapped my arms around him.
"Remember our first dance?" he said softly.
"I remember," I said, and in that moment I was transported, the two of us on the dance floor swaying to the music, his hands around my waist, feeling warm and happy and so, so in love, surrounded by tables full of people, one familiar face after another. "Look around," I had said to him. I pulled back slightly so I could look at his face. "Isn't this amazing? Everyone we love is here, my family, your family, our friends. When is this ever going to happen again?" He didn't look. He stared at me, intense. "Look around," I prompted again.
He didn't. "You and me," he said. "That's all I see. That's all that matters. You and me."
I'd stared at him, confused by his intensity, the urgency in his voice. He pulled me closer and I rested my head against his chest, anxious to escape that look.
"The vows I said to you, I meant every word," he told me. "No matter what happens in the future, never forget that. If things get rough, just remember, everything is for us. Everything I do, for the rest of my life, it'll be for us."
"I won't forget," I murmured, certain I never would, and at the same time wondering if the words would ever make sense. And as we swayed on the beach to the music of the waves, I put my head on his chest again, just as I did all those years before. I felt his warmth, heard his heartbeat. "I didn't forget," I whispered.
"Everything I did it for us," he said, "for our family."
I turned my head to the side so that I could see our kids, now hardly more than shadows against the darkening sky.
"So did I."
I pulled him closer.
"So did I."
"I'm going back," I say. The words sound right. The decision sounds right. The fact of the matter is, I've missed it. I've missed the thrill of opening up new intelligence reports, the anticipation, the feeling that a big break might be right around the corner, that any minute I could piece together a puzzle that would help my country. I did work hard to get where I am, and it's part of my identity, part of what makes me me.
You had me worried there for a minute, Omar says.
I see the relief on his face.
They're giving you even more access, you know.
We'll be able to accomplish a lot together. Start our own back channel, share information between our agencies, all that data that's needlessly restricted, we can really make a difference. That's what I want, isn't it? Always have, ever since joining the agency. But I don't feel the anticipation I thought I'd feel. The excitement, I don't feel much at all.
I might be deputy director, but my heart's always going to be in Russian CI.
I nod. A sense of unease is creeping over me. Did I make the right decision? It wouldn't be too late to change my mind.
And besides, you owe me.
The way he says it, the smile that doesn't quite reach his eyes, I'm not entirely sure he's kidding.
But the truth is, I do owe him. All those times he protected me, broke rules for me, shared information he shouldn't have, I'd be in jail if it weren't for him. Matt and I both would be.
We sit in silence for a few awkward moments. Then he cocks his head, gives me a long look.
Are you sure this is what you want, Vivian?
My mind goes to the kids, even though I don't want it to. But my babies aren't babies anymore. I had a year at home with them, that time I'd always wanted. I try to push them from my mind. A year ago, I would have said no. But the more time that's passed, the more certain I've become. All the reasons are there. It's the right choice. I'm sure. I close the door behind Omar and stand for a moment in the silence. There's a sadness settling over me, a vague sense of regret, and it doesn't quite make sense because I've had plenty of time to think this through. I hear Matt come into the room and don't turn. He comes up behind me, wraps his arms around my waist.
So, he says, did you make a decision?
I nod. There's still a hint of uncertainty in my mind, a sense that maybe I've chosen wrong. But he warned me I might feel that way the last time we talked about it. I'm going back. He lowers his head into the space between my neck and my shoulder, the spot that always sends a shiver running through me, and I can feel him smile. I think you made the right choice.
Epilogue.
Omar walks high on the ridgeline, the ocean to his left, helicopter straight ahead, set down on a barren stretch of dirt and patchy grass. He pulls a cell phone from his pocket, presses a button, holds it to his ear.
Sdrazvi, he says in greeting,
and then he listens.
Da,
he says as he walks. Another pause, and then he switches to English.
She's going back. I'll make the necessary arrangements.
He listens to the response.
A few months, maybe, but it'll be worth the wait.
He glances behind him, a quick glance, just to be sure there's still no one there.
I'll see what I can do, he says, and then, a moment later, a long game indeed.
A smile pulls at the corners of his mouth.
До свидания.
He takes the phone away from his ear, presses a button. He's close to the helicopter now, and the pilots started the propellers. They begin to whir slowly at first and then faster.